Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 186 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, please go to caropop.com. Our guest this week is the president of the Mobile Fidelity Sound Lab label and its parent company, Music Direct, Jim Davis. A few things up front. I own a lot of Mobile Fidelity albums, starting with those 70s go-tos, Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, and an album I played obsessively at loud volumes back in the day, Supertramp's Crime of the Century. In the 90s, I accumulated MoFi Gold CDs such as REM's Murmur and Reckoning, Nirvana's Nevermind, and Muddy Waters' Folksinger. After Mobile Fidelity went bankrupt in 1999, Jim Davis bought and relaunched the label. He had founded the mail-order audiophile equipment company Music Direct in 1993. I've gotten a lot of MoFi releases since then, vinyl as well as some SACDs, including titles by Elvis Costello, Miles Davis, Bob Dylan, Dire Straits, the B-52s, and of course, Love's Forever Changes. As someone who doesn't live far from Music Direct and MoFi's headquarters on Chicago's North Side, I also bought an amplifier and a MoFi turntable from Music Direct during the pandemic. Throughout the years, Mobile Fidelity has maintained a reputation as a top audiophile label. But in July 2022, Mike Esposito, owner of the Phoenix record store, The Ingroove, released a YouTube video asserting that despite touting its sourcing of original master tapes, MoFi actually was using digital copies in the production chain of many of its albums, including its priciest UltraDisc one-step pressings. MoFi confirmed that its mastering process was not all analog, and Davis posted an apology on the company's website that began, "We at Mobile Fidelity Sound Lab are aware of customer complaints regarding use of digital technology in our mastering chain. We apologize for using vague language, allowing false narratives to propagate, and for taking for granted the goodwill and trust our customers place in the Mobile Fidelity Sound Lab brand. We recognize our conduct has resulted in both anger and confusion in the marketplace. Moving forward, we are adopting a policy of 100% transparency regarding the provenance of our audio products." MoFi now labels specifically how each release is prepared. It also settled a class action fraud lawsuit for $25 million, with the company accepting returns for its albums. Almost 3 years after the controversy broke, that book is pretty much closed. Now Davis is eager to clear the air, and we talked in one of Music Direct's listening rooms. Was this a simple issue of miscommunication or a larger problem? How does the digital step factor into the quality of MoFi albums compared to the all-analog releases from, for instance, Analog Productions? Has MoFi demonstrated that a high-resolution digital step can result in the best-sounding audio available? Davis also gets into why MoFi moved on from half-speed mastering and the significance of its new super vinyl formulation and Fidelity record pressing plant. Buckle your seatbelts, folks, and please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Jim Davis. Hey, Jim, thanks for coming on Caro Pop. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
How long have you been at Music Direct, by the way?
I count the official start of Music Direct at 1993, so a little bit over 30 years.
What was your background going up to that?
This is pretty much the only sort of job I've had since I got out of college.
How did you start it? What's the origin story?
The origin story is I had always had an interest in music and in high-end audio. I had a cousin who owned a stereo store in a small town in Indiana where I grew up. And that started my interest in the high-end aspect. And when I got out of college, I started selling audio accessories and audiophile recordings. And then I slowly expanded my inventory, you know, to phono cartridges, you know, speaker stands, you know, just kind of miscellaneous type of things. And then eventually, you know, more real equipment, turntables, you know, amplifiers, speakers. And it's just been a slow progression over time to what we have now.
And at what point did you take over Mobile Fidelity, and how much did you sort of know Mobile Fidelity at that point? Like, had you listened to their records when you were younger?
Well, I was a seller of Mobile Fidelity records, you know, since the late 80s. And so I always had an interest in the record label. They really put out the best records, the best titles. And so I followed the label pretty closely. And then when they went bankrupt in 1999, the person that bought them out of bankruptcy, I purchased the remnants of Mobile Fidelity from that person. So we got all the equipment. We actually are using the exact same sound rooms that they originally had in Sebastopol, California. And we just kind of took it from there. And we slowly started to put out records, which were hard to get at the beginning because the old Mobile Fidelity kind of left some wreckage in their wake when they went bankrupt.
Well, and also this was a time when vinyl was kind of at a low, I would imagine, in terms of CDs really dominating the market. Was that part of the challenge of Mobile Fidelity being in business in the first place?
Well, Mobile Fidelity, of course, did gold CD, so they were certainly heavily into the digital aspect of music. So when we started, we put out both SACDs and we put out vinyl. But it was definitely a low ebb for vinyl at that point in time. It never went away for audiophiles. But it was certainly not as strong as CDs were.
Yeah, I have a bunch of those gold CDs from the 90s, so this would have been before your time with it. Was it the Gain 2 method on that? And I remember you used to be able to find them pretty reasonably priced, like you'd sort of walk into, Strawberry's chain store or something. They'd have, Asia and Murmurs, REM's Reckoning or something like that. Was part of the thing that CDs, there just wasn't as much of a distinction in audiophile quality for those formats as opposed to vinyl? Or was it really just, just what the market was at that point?
I think it was just what the market was at that point. I mean, our versions were, those gold CDs were certainly the best versions that were out there, the same kind of techniques, mastering techniques that they use now, they used back then. And, it's the kind of attention to detail that you didn't see back then and still don't see now for most releases.
When Mobile Fidelity rebooted, what was it that you wanted to make sure you did the same, and what was it that you wanted to do differently?
Well, we certainly really wanted to bring back vinyl. So, one of the first things we did is we went out and bought a lathe, old Neumann lathe, and we wanted to get back into vinyl.
So what was like the first vinyl that you did at that point?
The first vinyl we did was we did a deal with Fantasy Records, and we put out Isaac Hayes. We put out some of their jazz records. I think it was a Coleman Hawkins. We did Miles Davis. They had a quite extensive jazz catalog.
So when I was growing up, I remember like some of the first fancy records I got was like the Mobile Fidelity half speed master of Dark Side of the Moon, of course, everyone I think got that, and also Supertramp's Crime of the Century. My dad bought iRobot, Alan Parsons Project. When you started up again, were you still doing the half speed master, or was the technique different at that point?
When we started back up, we were still doing half speed mastering, which, for people who aren't familiar with that. Basically, everything is shifted down, I guess an octave, and they have to play the tape at half the speed, you master at that half speed, which means you're listening to it, like this, and you have to make all your EQs and all your fades and adjustments at half the speed of normal.
And is that an optimal way of doing things, or did you ultimately decide, that's not the best way to do it?
This went back to the old Mobile Fidelity. Okay. They were doing their records half-speed master. And I think the theory was that you would get a better high frequency response with half speed mastering. We did experiments using, you know, taking the same program, cutting it both ways. And at the end of the day, we felt real-time mastering was a little bit better than half-speed mastering. And in addition, it takes way less time to master the title.
So what do you think the reason for that was? I mean, I know you're not alone in thinking that. I think it was Kevin Gray in one of these also has said he just doesn't think the half-speed actually helps you.
I think it's a better question for the engineers. I think that's a question for engineers for sure. Yeah.
And also in terms of like doing SACDs versus vinyl, are there different techniques to get each one, or are you able to pretty much, you know, come up with the best version of it and, you know, have one go off to SACD and one be mastered for vinyl?
So we have separate engineers for mastering the vinyl and for making the SACDs, and they definitely take their own path. Both the two formats have different dynamic ranges, and so you do have to master within those parameters. I would say we try to keep them reasonably close, though. I mean, we don't want to have, you know, an SACD that sounds radically different from the vinyl, so we don't want to go too far outside the normal for a particular record. But they definitely use a little bit different techniques for each one.
Right. So you're actually using different paths to try to get to almost the same point.
Right.
And how much, in terms of the industry, SACDs, what's that market been like over the years, and like how does that do now compared to vinyl, and how did it do compared to vinyl when you guys started?
When we first started, SACDs were you know, sold very, very well, and then over time, as vinyls, you know, kind of made its resurgence, then the sales of SACDs had definitely dropped. Recently, they have, however, edged back up a little bit, and it is mostly content driven. If it's a big record that everyone wants to hear, then our sales have been very robust on those particular titles. I also think there's a little bit of cost considerations involved. Vinyl has got a lot more expensive over the last few years, and CDs haven't really gone up much, if at all. And I think some people are deciding they want to get more bang for their buck, and so they'll go with the SACD.
Is it a problem with fewer manufacturers making SACD players now?
It's a problem that it could become a big issue in the future. There are definitely the issue isn't the people making them as much as the people who make the transports that would go inside them, those are still being made, but that could stop at any time.
So an SACD, any sort of CD, obviously is a digital technology, and it's a high fidelity digital technology that you're using for that. There's obviously, as you've come to know, this audience of people who think, you know, all analog is by far superior to everything and everything needs to be analog. What is your ultimate feeling on the whole analog versus digital thing, and, you know, when is one appropriate to use over the other?
Well, we pretty much exclusively use a DSD transfer off of an analog tape for a variety of reasons, but one, we feel we make a better transfer than can be done directly off the analog tape. And it sounds like an oxymoron a little bit, like how can a copy sound better than the original? And the reason for it is everyone is making a copy. When someone cuts directly from the original analog master to a lacquer, they are making a copy of that master tape. That's not a one for one transfer. The things that are done in between make a big difference. And when we make a DSD transfer, we can make what I would have to call a as close to perfect transfer, or and we extract the maximum amount of information that's available on that original master tape. And we can do that because we can take the time to get azimuth adjustments, perfectly aligned, which is something that when someone cuts from a tape, can't really do. So in a master tape, you're going to have splices. So there'll be a splice between every song, and then there'll be, depending on the song, will be splices in the song itself. So sometimes they put a new chorus in, or they swap out this guitar solo for this guitar solo. And so there can be multiple splices in one particular song. So at each splice, we take, we adjust azimuth. So you do this by hearing, but also use an oscilloscope. And on the oscilloscope, you can tell when you're perfectly aligned. So when you adjust azimuth, you're basically adjusting the tape head so that it is aligned to, essentially mirrors the tape in its relationship to the tape recorder they were using in the studio. And if it's not aligned, you're not getting 100% of the information. So when someone cuts an analog directly from the analog, so at every splice, I mean, they can run the tape down and they can say, well, this is where I need to be, when this song starts. But they're trying to do whatever they're doing all at one time. They're trying to make fades at the end, and they're trying to adjust the azimuth, all these little things that they have to do, and they're never going to get it precise. And that's what we can do, is do it precisely, because we can do one song at a time, one splice to one splice at a time. And so we wind up with basically a close to perfect transfer from that tape. I just don't believe that people who cut directly from the analog can achieve that kind of precision. And it means we have more information that we're putting onto that lacquer. And that's the difference. The copy can sound better than the original because someone coming from the original didn't necessarily do that great of a job putting it onto that lacquer.
Right. So for people who aren't, for listeners who aren't the ones who are on the Steve Hoffman boards debating this stuff in infinitesimal detail, like, tell me, let's back up and tell me what DSD is and sort of how you became acquainted with it.
So DSD was a digital format that Sony came up with in, I would say, the mid to late 90s. It was designed as an archiving format. How you hear 16-bit 44 kilohertz, as a CD format, it's called what they call single bit. And then it samples, I think it was 2.4 million times per second. So it's a different way of capturing digitally. We currently use what we would call 4X DSD or 256K DSD. So it's, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but it's just about as close to what would be considered theoretical analog as you could probably get. Certainly within human hearing, I don't think you could hear any difference if you doubled or quadrupled the number that we have now.
Right. And when you guys started using DSD, what was it? Was it 56 or?
They called it 64K.
64. Sorry.
Yeah.
And was this introduced to you because you're like, hey, you know what? It's more of an issue trying to get this off of the analog master, and we're just getting better copies this way.
It was an evolution over time. Our engineers are constantly experimenting. It's why we went from half speed master to real time mastering, because we're always looking at, well, what is really the best technique what's the best way to master? And we just don't say, well, it's just, I'm going to do it the way I've done it for 40 years. I mean, we want to try to push the envelope and advance the art. And it was just a function of their familiarity, because they did the digital, the SACDs, kind of married with the analog part of it.
Right. Do you think the vinyl is ultimately, like, are you able to still get, doing the DSD and going back to analog for the vinyl, are you able to pull more of the sound out than for SACD, or are they comparable?
That's an ongoing debate, right? I mean, in theory, you have wider dynamic range. There should be more information on an SACD or CD, for that matter, over vinyl.
And if you've already gone digital, then maybe the digital format, in theory, would be the ultimate format. Yet it doesn't seem like that's the case.
I think that's always in, on the eye of the beholder, right? Or the ear of the beholder. I think the proof is sitting down and listening. Listen to the record. If you want to listen to another version of it, great. But I mean, at the end of the day, these are all philosophical debates, and you just need to sit down and listen to it. Does it sound good? Does it sound great? And our records consistently got praise from everyone. Whether it was analog or digital or not, some of the best records we got the most praise on were digital recordings to begin with. Dire Straits' Brothers in Arms, is famously, one of the earliest digital recordings.
Right.
Why does it sound so good?
I picked that one up from you guys, and I was sort of like, also a little bit like, well, this one's digital originally, so I'm not quite sure why this one would sound good, but it does.
But when you put it on vinyl, there's some kind of whatever they, third order harmonics or whatever they want to call it. There's pleasant noise, maybe is a way to describe it. But I think it's the vinyl format in general that has this warmth to it that people find pleasant to listen to.
So was there a period in which you guys were, like, some of the records coming out were DSD and some of them were just all analog, and it was kind of split for a while?
There was probably a period, we really started doing the DSD in about 2013, I think, was our first, release that was done from a DSD transfer. So we were doing some analog cuts throughout that time period. But at a certain point, I think we did one final one in 2021. And at that point in time, we pretty much, only do the DSD transfers or cut from those transfers.
Right. What was the first one you did?
The first one, I think, was maybe a Billy Joel title. I would have to look that up.
All right, but, yeah. Stranger, 52nd Street.
So, yeah, those were the two first ones we did. So,
some of them you did, and some of them you didn't, and it was just was there a reason some were DSD and some weren't, or was it just a matter of, production? You were able to do a certain number one way and a certain number the other.
Sometimes it depended on the accessing the tape. So, if they sent us the tape, then we could cut from the analog. And if we had to go do a trip, for instance, so for Billy Joel, we would had to send our equipment to New York, to Sony Studio, to their facility, and then access the tape there. And the only real way to do that was really to be able to do the DSD transfer.
Right. Yeah, if there's a company that's not going to let it out of their building, you need to figure out a way to copy it.
But at this point in time, even the tapes we do get in-house, we do the digital transfer.
Right. And then some of the releases obviously say Mobile Fidelity Sound Lab. What's the distinction on those? Is that where you're not able to do it from the original master recording?
So if it says original master recording, that was, we had an original we had access to an original master tape. And if it says Mobile Fidelity Sound Lab, we either had access to a copy tape, or we couldn't determine if it was the original master. So for instance, the band, that tape was kind of notorious for being missing and not available. We got that, and our engineers will tell you up and down that was the master. But because it had been touted as this master has been missing for 30 years, we went ahead and put the MoFi stripe on it. So if we have doubts about it, we will just put the MoFi stripe.
Yeah, like B-52s, love those first couple records. You guys put those out. I think those are Sound Lab. Were those masters not available, or...?
So that was the Silver Series,
okay,
which was 120 gram record, or 140 gram records, not 180 gram. And that whole series says Mobile Fidelity Sound Lab on it, and not because of the master tape. So some of those Silver Series are from original master tapes.
Okay. So what's the distinction? Is it just because you're making it on service?
That was a decision about that particular series that we made years and years ago.
Okay. So, but the difference in that is that it's like a lighter vinyl, and
that was the idea, yeah.
Okay, so it's trying to be a slightly more of an entry point.
Correct.
So, yeah. But because it still sounds really good. So again, to my ears, I can't tell if you took it from the master tape or not.
Right.
So, and then I have someone like the Stevie Wonders, and he's notorious for not letting his masters out. So
those were copy tapes. So, I can confirm that.
So did they give you a copy tape then? They said, look, we're not, Stevie's not letting...
That's essentially the scenario.
When you were making the shift to DSD, did you have in the back of your mind that, this was a potentially toxic topic for some people? Like the idea that there's a digital step? Or did it take you by surprise when there was this, surge of, outrage over learning that there was this digital step in what you guys are doing?
No, we were not concerned at all. I mean, we wanted to put out the best possible record. We felt that DSD allowed us to do that. And so, no, there was no discussions about, we better not, we hope no one finds out about our dirty little secret, because we didn't feel there was a secret to keep. Our techniques... we consider proprietary. I mean, we have 100 years of mastering engineer experience in totality with our engineers, and they are constantly evolving. And so this was just one more evolution.
Right. I mean, do you guys think that there were any steps along the way where you look back and think, oh, I wish we'd been more transparent about, how we portrayed this, from the, taking it from the original master or whatever, however it was.
Well, hindsight's always 20/20, of course, but if there was any inflection point where I would have wished that we would have done this, it would have been after we put out the first one-step record, which was Santana and Abraxas. It's universally, revered. At that point in time, it would have been a particular pleasure in coming back out and saying that record that you think is the best record you've ever heard, that came from a DSD 64K DSD transfer.
Right. Like all the one steps are from DSDs, right?
They are, correct.
And that's your highest
end. Oh, actually, I take that back. There's only one. The second one we put out was from Analog Tape directly.
Which was that?
That was a Bill Evans record. That was the only one, just because they got the Analog Tape. And one reason if they ever would choose to do analog, is where you basically had a very consistent azimuth all the way through, especially when you have no breaks. Some jazz records, it's one continuous track. And in those cases, why it wasn't the worst decision to, to do it from the analog tape.
Right. But like the one steps in general are your highest end audio file releases.
Correct.
And they were being reviewed as such before this DSD step was revealed to anyone.
Sure.
So your feeling was, well, proof's in the pudding, right? The, you know, people are buying these for a lot of money and enjoying them. So
the work speaks for itself. People had nothing to say but high praise for those records. Whether there was a DSD step or it was all analog makes no difference. And people heard what they heard.
So were you surprised when this all blew up and the Washington Post did their story? And before that, there was, you know, the guy who was sort of like, wait a minute, I've discovered, you know, this digital step in there. Like, what was like, tell me about, like, from your point of view, what it was like to go through all of that, if it's not too painful.
It's not the most pleasant of memories, of course. The question came up because this was during the pandemic, and the sales of these one-step records had increased steadily. And so we went from doing 2,500 on Abraxas to 5,000 for Nightfly, and, you know, we were up selling, you know, 10,000 of each one. And so we announced Thriller at 40,000 units. And if you are doing all analog, in theory, you would be hitting that master tape up every multiple times to produce the number of stampers that you would need for a one step. So a one step, to clarify for people, basically, it's removing a couple of steps in making stampers to press records. Normal records are done with what they call a three-step process. So they have a father, they have a mother, and then you can make stampers from the mother. The one-step basically takes the cut, the lacquer, and turns, you know, metallizes that and basically turns it, into a stamper. So you can only make what essentially is one stamper when you do a one-step plating. So one step, that means that out of, say, a typical set of stampers, you might be able to get somewhere between as little as 500, but maybe as many as 1,500 pressed records out of a set of stampers before they fail. And one thing that people, I think, are mistaken about quite often is that the stampers for records don't wear out as far as the grooves. What happens for stampers is they almost always break somewhere. So from the repeated pressure, the outer edge or the inner diameter of the stamper is what it'll crack. At that point in time, you have to use another stamper. But the actual grooves themselves, there are companies who say, well, we'll only press 1,000 records off a set of stampers. But they're implying that those grooves wear out. I mean, I don't know how many you'd have to press for them to really have a degradation, but it would be many thousands. And the stamper would have long broken before you could get to that number.
So you think it's arbitrary to say we're only doing 1,000 per stamper?
It's a marketing thing.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, so to make that many stampers for one step, you would have to, say, cut Michael Jackson 40 times to cut that. And that would mean you would hit the master, you would be running it through your machine at least 40 times to be able to produce enough stampers so you could press that number. And so the question people had was, well, you might be endangering the master tape by playing it that many times.
Right.
So that's where the kind of rumors, you know, and the innuendo started to develop, and then it kind of snowballed from there.
Right. And so, John Wood invited the guy who raised the question out to see how it was done, and basically was transparent about how this was being made, right?
They made a video which was I didn't approve, they did make this video, and at that point in time, then that's the firestorm went into,
because it was kind of the reveal that, oh yeah, we're using DSD, and then the reaction to that was, oh, you've misrepresented this all these years, and
yeah.
Then you had a lawsuit and.
Right. Except that if you look through any of our marketing literature, at no time do we use the term all analog. It never happened. You can look through every advertisement, every one sheet, everything that we put out there, emails, in terms of our marketing of these records, and all analog was not mentioned. So, I mean, there are obviously competitors of ours who all analog is one of their selling points.
Right, or they have analog in the name of the company or something. So
sure.
So what was the reason you guys settled?
Well, as many people know, I mean, you know, settling is generally the cheapest option. But I think I want to make it clear that this lawsuit, while there are some all analog acolytes that certainly, you know, generate a lot of buzz on forums and other discussion groups, the reality is this lawsuit was mostly driven by speculators. So Mobile Fidelity's always been extremely collectible record label. In fact, I would call it the most collectible record label in the world as a whole. And, our records, when they go out of print, go up in value. I mean, an Abraxas, you know, that we only made 2,500 goes, you know, can go for as much as $2,000.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've seen it, you know, in 1,000 at least.
Right. So what happened is, especially during the pandemic, you had people that basically were making a cottage industry out of buying up Mobile Fidelity product, and then when it went out of print, then they would sell it for a profit. And in fact, the original lawsuit was filed by two guys who were doing that, you know, for you know, as a side hustle.
So the complaint really was it wasn't, oh, these records don't sound as good as they should have. It's that you've reduced the value of them because they're not as pure as we thought they were in some way.
That was their, I'm going to be stuck with a whole bunch of records that I thought were going to be worth more money. Now they're not going to be worth as much money. And that's why that was the impetus for the lawsuit.
Right. And part of the settlement was that people could return records that they'd bought.
We had three different levels to our settlement. And, one of them was that you could return the records that you bought. Well, more than half of the records we received back were sealed.
That was my next question. Thank you.
And some people might send back 5, 6, 10 copies of the same record. So that's why I say it's almost completely driven by speculation.
Right. Yeah, it's this weird kind of market thing that, you know, it's sort of driven by what you see on Discogs more than what you're hearing in your, you know, in your speakers. And it drives me kind of crazy sometimes when something that I want gets sold out because I'm not someone who flips records. And then immediately you'll see them twice the price on Discogs. So in a way, on one hand, you're the beneficiaries of people wanting to buy more copies of your product because they think it's so valuable. And then on the other hand, you're getting 5 sealed copies of something back because they're like, oh, you know, this was like my, you know, sort of Bitcoin of my audio Bitcoin instead of something that's actually something that's meant to give me pleasure, which is why you've gone to all the trouble to make the records in the first place.
I believe the quote I heard from one of the lawsuit participants was, "I was planning on putting my daughter through college with this."
Did you notice also that the titles that were returned tended to be the ones with a lower resale value? Like, I bet nobody returned an Abraxas One Step to you.
Surprisingly enough, one person returned an Abraxas.
What?
And it was the only thing they had ever bought ever from us. So that was really surprising. But yes, the titles that were returned were basically the ones we produced the most of. No surprise there. I mean, the stuff that there was too much supply and not enough demand for.
Now they're planning the crime of the century. Well, what will it be?
You run Music Direct.
Yes.
And Mobile Fidelity is part of Music Direct. How big a part of Music Direct is Mobile Fidelity?
It's about 20% of our business.
So, and is most of it equipment that you're selling, like, you know, speakers and amplifiers and turntables and whatever else? Like, how does it break down?
Yeah, about 70% of our business is audio hardware gear.
Got it. And then what's the other 10%?
Other music, other than Mobile Fidelity.
Right. Yeah, of course. Yes. Yeah. You could buy those other labels even through you guys. How much did this affect the company as a whole, this whole lawsuit and settlement and everything?
Well, financially, it was a drain, certainly, but not a drain that we weathered and have moved past. At this point in time, it doesn't really affect us. The music industry or vinyl industry in general has dropped since the pandemic, which is not a surprise to anybody. So whether it's Mobile Fidelity Records or other people's releases, nobody's selling as much vinyl as they did during the pandemic.
What about the audio equipment?
Oh, well, audio equipment also peaked out during the pandemic as well. Now that people aren't stuck at home, they have other things to spend their money on. So things are really back to what they were normal before the pandemic.
Right. How did the Thriller end up doing, by the way? You did Thriller and then you did Off the Wall, both of which I have.
So Thriller, I mean, did great. I mean, we've sold, it's the most we've sold of any One Step by far.
And how about Off the Wall? Off the Wall sounds like it. That really jumps out of the speakers.
Off the Wall sounds great. I mean, in some ways, I think it sounds better than Thriller. And but we did cap that at 6,000 units. It's basically on the verge of being sold out.
So. Got it. Kevin Gray, master and engineer. I had him on earlier in the year, and he set off one of these Steve Hoffman Music Forum threads. Because he was saying that he thought that One Steps were inferior to Three Steps, and that it's all sort of a scam. The music public has been gullible and buying into these One Steps. What is your thought on that?
I mean, when we listen to our One Steps versus our regular versions, I think that. That our One Steps, sound superior. I mean, we have a Braxis that we put out recently on the Super Vinyl, the higher quality vinyl. Sounds great, but, the One Step is a little bit better. So he feels, I believe, that it rolls off because of the way plate the lacquer, that it rolls off some high frequencies, which that's his belief. So I think it all has to do with mastering for that format. So, at MoFi, we just don't like master the same way for everything. I mean, how the Super Vinyl sounds, you master to that particular vinyl formulation. We know how One Step sounds, we master to that particular technique. So it's just not one size fits all for us.
Right. And when you do something like you had a One Step of Muddy Waters' Folk Singer, and Analog Productions had their 45 RPM version of that, when you decide to do a title that's already been done by someone else on sort of the high end, are you kind of A-B-ing the two and saying, all right, we think we could do this one even better? Like, what's the thought process? And
if we don't think we can beat the existing versions, then we don't do it. So when we decide to do a title, we get in the tape, and do our transfer, but we also listen to any other versions that are out there, particularly whatever the original was, and then any other versions that are highly regarded. So in the instance of the Muddy Waters, we definitely got in competing copies like the Analog Productions, and A-beat against those.
And at the end of the day, you guys thought yours was better.
Yeah. I will say this, that the equipment you listen to records on can be exceptionally important. And you can listen to one record on one system and hear a clear winner. And you, but you could change out something in that system, or you could go to someone else's house and listen to on their turntable and not get a night and day the opposite way. But it's surprising how much the equipment does make a difference,
right,
in how something sounds. So if when someone makes puts out their opinion, well, I think this one sounds better, I'm more interested in collective opinions. So in other words, if a majority of people, you know, or a super majority of people say our version sounds better than this version, to me that's more indicative of how good a job we've done. But one individual person saying I prefer this one over that one, I don't think is quite as relevant, because I've heard how different systems can affect the sound of the playback.
Right. Is there also like a competition among these higher end labels in terms of, you know, who's going to do the one step for, you know, whether it's the Michael Jackson or Steely Dan or whoever else? Like, are you kind of going up against, you know, your Analog Productions or your, you know, Kraft for whatever they're doing, or you know, Impex, or name your label? Is that like a competitive situation at this point?
Well, there's a little bit of competition there. You know, the record label ultimately makes the decision about, you know, who they want to go with. But we certainly, you know, advocate, you know, for us to get the best records. And I think we've done a pretty good job of accessing some of the best recordings of all time.
Right. Well, it was interesting because you guys had that, you were putting out those Dire Straits ones. And my impression was that Mark Knopfler was pretty closely, you know, working with you on those. And yet Warner's re-released those not that long afterwards, but my memory of it is, at least. You know, do you have to sort of keep tabs on that? Like, well, wait a minute, if you're gonna put these out at the same time we're putting this out, you know, you need to give us this kind of window or these kind of numbers or something like that.
The record label is more concerned about that than we are. I think our versions stand on their own. You know, they're audiophile versions. So I'm less concerned with what the record labels are putting out, but they can sometimes be concerned that there's not a conflict between their version and our version in terms of timing.
All right. And then I did want to talk about the Super Vinyl too, because that seems like one of the latest kind of evolutions. And like the Miles Davis records, you'd released on not Super Vinyl, and now they've been coming out again on Super Vinyl. Do you have to remaster them because the formulation's different? And like, what's the kind of leap? Like, how does that all work?
So you do. The formulation is about 6 dB lower in the noise floor than standard vinyl. It's fairly significant, but it does require you to do a different to master differently than you would be if you were cutting it onto regular vinyl.
So there'll be Miles Davis is on the corner, or Jack Johnson or something. Are you A-B-ing those two and being like, okay, this is like 30% better, or like how does it? You know, what's the kind of advantage of getting the Super Vinyl to what you put out previously?
There's a constant A-B against the previous version that we did. So now a lot of those particular ones are 33s, where the other versions we did are 45s, except for On the Corner. But a lot of the Miles Davis we did are 2LP 45s. So the 45 has its own characteristic that 45 in general is just, it's a superior format to a 33 sonically.
Right.
It's got its drawbacks though. It's got its 9 or 12 minute sides or, you know, that's the major drawback for 45. But sonically 45 is pretty consistently better than 33.
Right. Yeah. That's the problem with Miles Davis, is that you'll have these long albums like On the Corner, but there are these long songs that you don't want to break in half to put them on. Because in theory, an album that's like longer than 50 minutes, you probably would rather put it on four sides than two. But the way those records are constructed, it would be kind of hard to do that.
Oh, anytime there's a long song like that, we will not chop it in half. So you know that we're pretty consistent that if there are tracks that won't fit it, you know, we will not truncate a track and start it on another record.
All right. And then when you have something that comes out on like a one step and on super vinyl or whatever, do you find that will people buy both of them, or do they kind of cannibalize the sales of each other a little bit? Like, I think ELO's El Dorado has come out in a few different vinyl formats.
Certainly, a lot of audiophiles will certainly buy both. So you see that quite often. As far as putting out two different, like El Dorado, I think in the future we're planning having less crossover like that. So we're not going to be trying to put out a one-step version, you know, and a super vinyl version, you know, 33 like we did with El Dorado. So that you probably won't see that in the future. What you might see is we do a one-step version. It sells out. And then later on, we might do a 2LP 45 that's just standard vinyl, not a one-step.
Got it. And you've been rolling out the Van Halen catalog lately, so you have those. What else is coming up that people should be looking out for and that you're especially excited about that you can announce?
That's always the key, right?
Yeah, I saw that pause.
We have some really, really exciting stuff coming out next year, some of which, you know, I can't discuss, but we will be doing the rest of the Michael Jackson catalog.
All of it?
Pretty much all of it, yeah, even through the 3LP history set.
Are you going to go back before Off the Wall, too? Are you going to put out, you know, I don't know, Ben Got to Be There?
No discussions on that at this point in time, but pretty much from everything from Off the Wall
Dangerous,
on, yeah,
history, all that stuff.
Yeah, there'll be announcements periodically over the next year when those are ready to come out.
Did the lawsuit affect your sales moving forward, other than just what, you know, the general drop in the vinyl market?
General drop in the vinyl market, it was more of a factor than anything else. The fact that the year that we had the lawsuit, we actually had our highest sales ever. And that was higher after the lawsuit was announced.
Huh.
For that particular. After that, the pandemic started to wane, and then that's when, you know, sales in general started to drop. But you know, they haven't dropped that much. They're still, you know, reasonably robust. What you don't see is people buying two copies at one time like you did during the pandemic.
Right.
So one to play and one to sell.
People probably are still doing that, but they're not buying one to play and five to sell or something like that. Yeah,
we see certainly less of the buy one to, you know, they want to get the one record. They're just not going to get the second one to sell it off.
Right. Do you have any white whales of, you know, albums that you've just wanted to do on MoFi all this time that you just haven't quite been able to get yet?
We've had deals on some of my Touchstone records that have got close but never quite there. I always cite Clash, London Calling as probably one of the records, one of my favorite records I would love to put out, and we almost got there, but not quite.
Are like the 70s sort of the sweet spot for like the big sales? Do people just, is that what people still associate most with audiophile, you think?
I would say so. However, I think there's a kind of a big pent up demand for 90s records. We just put out a Stone Temple Pilots record, the Tiny Music. And I think it's done very well so far. So I think that there's a lot of 90s stuff that would be great to put out. It is unfortunately more difficult to license stuff from the 90s. I think that's when the contracts got a little bit more sophisticated.
Interesting. Also, like the 90s, I'm also always curious about kind of how they were recorded, because that's when more stuff was done digitally, but then some stuff is still analog. And again, not that that needs to define it, everything. But it just seems like there's a lot more sort of variance in how stuff was recorded then, as opposed to something from 73. You know, you figure you pretty much know how it was recorded. Whether it was recorded well or not is a different matter.
It's all over the place for 90s. What you assume is digital can be analog. What little we've done, we've run into both at this point.
Are there any that you've done that you would sort of want to go back to, and you're like, you know what, I feel like now with what we know, we could do this one better?
So the early vinyl that we did, some of that I think we could go back and do a better job, because over time, our cutting system got more and more refined over time, whether it was the half-speed mastering or switch to real-time mastering. The lathe, the fine-tuning on the lathe, we changed cutter heads, back at the end of, somewhere around 2009, 2010, we changed cutter heads. I think that the improvements in the system in general, we could do better jobs than we did on those records.
And is there a philosophy from the early MoFi stuff that like Stan Ricker was doing that kind of carries over to today? Or is it really just a matter of, look, we do things as well as we can today, just like they did things as well as they could back then?
Well, Stan was the mentor to the guy who cuts our records now, Krieg, and his influence is ongoing. But I do believe we've advanced past what Stan was able to do with whatever equipment he had, and what was considered, to be great sound. I think we have never done better product. We've never put out better releases.
If you guys got Dark Side of the Moon now, it would be better than the classic 70s Dark Side.
Hard to say, because we don't know what condition the tape is in.
Right.
But if the tape was on identical condition with what they had access to back then, I do believe we put out a superior version.
All right. So, and you guys also opened a pressing plant, Fidelity Pressing Plant. Like, how's that going?
It's going great. We got 6 presses out in Oxnard, California. It's a partnership between me and Rick Hashimoto and Edward Hashimoto, who used to be at RTI Record Pressing, and brand new presses. So I really think that we're putting out really the best vinyl, at least in the U.S. I don't think there's anyone that's putting out better consistent quality.
So you're doing all the mobile fidelity stuff there.
Yes.
And then other companies, I think Impex, I think they press some stuff there too.
Impex is pressing something at our plant. Rhino Records is doing their Reserve series at our pressing plant.
Okay.
Concord's done a couple of titles, and we also are doing, some other outside work. There's a severe overcapacity now for record pressing in the U.S. So it's not an easy environment to get new clients. But I think if you want a high quality record, we are the destination now. And over time, we'll get busier and busier.
So there was a period where everyone was like, oh my God, there's like a year long wait just to get my record pressed or something. Is that done?
That's done. So it was a combination of the pandemic ending, the big pressing plants overexpanding. So there was a huge overexpansion of kind of your, I would call, commodity level record pressing. So the cheapest pressings are done mostly by two companies at this point in time, 2 or 3 companies in the U.S. They more than doubled their capacity. Pretty much at the wrong time.
Right. And a lot of them go overseas too. I see a lot of them pressed at, was it GZ and Czechoslovakia, I think?
Yeah, and GZ owns some pressing plants in the bigger pressing plants in the U.S. as well.
Got it. How important is it for you to have outside clients for the pressing plant aside from the MoFi stuff?
It's very important. I mean, obviously we want to make the plant, you know, as successful as possible, and we want to fill up all the presses, and you need outside work to do that. At this point in time, Mobile Fidelity is probably, 60% of our capacity.
Do you feel like there's a jump in the quality of what you're doing because you're able to press your own at this point?
There is. Because I think that the Hashimoto's really, quality is their number one byword, they've really developed a great operation there for delivering the best possible records.
And then also you have the MoFi audio equipment that you're selling, like the speakers, turntables. How is that going?
That's going pretty well. We had the same kind of post-pandemic drop that every other electronics manufacturer had. We put together, we didn't have, unlike MoFi, we didn't have these years and years of experience, that we could draw upon. So we went out and basically, partnered with, people like Alan Perkins, or Andrew Jones, for speakers, basically leveraged their expertise into putting out products that they were really behind, and that we thought fit, what we were trying to accomplish in terms of associating the MoFi name with kind of studio level gear.
Right. Yeah, and I know I've noticed that, and there seems to be an evolution of the speakers and the turntables, and that you've had, already like a few different, versions of stuff coming up. How is that all evolving?
We're generally going upscale, we started out at, a cheaper turntable, and we've kind of gone up to our current master deck. Same thing with speakers, now we're going to have coming out with the V10 huge floor standing speaker. So the whole idea here really has been, to kind of keep going up the quality scale.
Right. And does that affect the Music Direct side of it, where you're also selling other companies, audio equipment, or is it just one other thing?
No, for Music Direct, it's one more brand, and we sell it to distribution side of the company that sells it to other dealers in the U.S. I don't have any problem having competition from our competitors on our products that we originate. Well, actually, there is one subject about mastering that I didn't really touch upon, but I think is really important, and why it sets Mobile Fidelity apart. And I give our engineers the luxury of time. That's the one thing that in a commercial setting that mastering engineers generally don't have. They get a project or to cut a record, and they might have 4 hours to do it, or they might have a day, maybe. But I give our guys the luxury of time. They do it until they think it's right. And that means that whole process of comparing the other versions that exist out there. We've had records where we've had to recut 7, 8, 9 times. I'm talking about the initial version of it. Because there was something that they thought they could do better or wasn't quite right, and they just kept going until they got it right. And they've had records where it's taken a month for them to do that whole process. That would never happen at a commercial facility. And I, quite frankly, I don't think really happens with the well-respected, granted, mastering engineers that some of our more direct competitors use. I don't think that they're sitting out there taking, a week or 2 weeks to cut product. They do it, and, maybe they'll recut it again if they, if there's, something wrong with it, or, there's the metal got messed up. But we are at it until it's done.
Can you think of any that have been particularly challenging where they just really had to keep going back to get it to the place where you were all happy with it?
Well, I'll cite one that, I mean, you know, I talked about the splices, you know, and having to do these azimuth adjustments. And this was an SACD, actually, I take that back. It was both final and SACD. Waiting for Columbus, Little Feet.
Right.
It's a live album. I believe it's a couple different shows that they had to cut together. My understanding is that there were somewhere in the area of 200 splices. That took over a month to do.
Wow.
Because they were optimizing for each splice. So that's probably the worst one the most notorious one. But I'm sure the engineers have got examples where it's, you know, they've had to cut it, you know, multiple times trying to get something correct.
What of the releases you've done do you remember being the most blown away by the first time you heard it?
Well, certainly Abraxas sounds like it just kind of, you know, especially the one step just, I mean, people loved it because, I mean, it just comes out of this black background, right? I mean, it's so crystal clear. And I think, you know, the beginning, there's those little tinkly, that's certainly one that is very memorable the first time you hear it. It's just, you know, so I'd probably cite that as my...
That's it for episode 186 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Jim Davis for taking us through the history of mobile fidelity and Music Direct, offering his perspective on that lawsuit, and explaining how his company aims to produce the highest quality audio.